Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Can everyone hear me? Thank you. Welcome to the Wollongong Local Planning Panel. My name is Robert Montgomery. I'm the chair of the panel this afternoon. The Wollongong Local Planning Panel is an independent panel constituted under the Environmental Planning and Assessment Act. The panel has the role of the consent authority on most applications. In particular tonight, there's three items on the agenda. The panel will be making decisions in relation to items one and three, and item two, the council have requested advice from the panel, and the council will then subsequently make the decision. I'll just introduce each of the panel members.
Good evening. My name's Larissa Rozog. My expertise is in town planning and project management. I've had over 20 years' experience in both those sectors, in local government and private enterprise.
Steve.
I'm Steve Fermio. I'm an environmental earth scientist with about 30 years' experience in planning and environmental management, and I'm also on the Lane Cove panel.
And Bernard?
I come from a construction and consulting background. I'm the community representative. I've lived in the area for the past 32 years.
My background is in town planning. I've have some 38 years' experience in town planning, including local government, state government and private practice. I've also been appointed by the Minister for Planning as alternative chairs for Lane Cove and Bayside Council, and I sit as experts on those panels as well. Panel this afternoon, the panel's been out to each site that's on the agenda. We've read the papers prepared by the council staff, which I'm sure you would have seen on the council's website. We've also seen all of the submissions that were made and have read those submissions. The way that the panel operates is that we will hear from speakers first. We'll go in order of the agenda, the items on the agenda. We'll hear from submitters first, and then we'll hear from the applicant. The submitters have 5 minutes to speak. The council staff have a timer, and if you do go for your 5 minutes, you'll hear an audible sound. If you haven't finished, I'll ask you to finish up quickly at that point in time. For those of you who aren't used to speaking, 5 minutes goes very quickly. And when I call your name, I'll ask you to sit at the desk up the front, speak into the microphone. The meeting is recorded, and those recordings are available publicly after the meeting, so you need to be speaking into the microphone for the record. When we ask the applicants to speak, we may give them a little bit more time than the submitters, because the panel's expectation of the applicants is that they will, we expect them to respond to the issues that may have been raised by various submitters before them. Okay, in terms of decisions and minutes, once we finish the public part of the meeting, we'll formally close the meeting. The panel will then deliberate, make its decisions and recommendations, and those decisions and recommendations will be published on Council's website, generally within 3 working days. So we'll start on the agenda. Item one is a proposal, proposed multi-dwelling housing at 32 Kem Lawarra Road, Warrawong. It's an item that's submitted to the council for decision. I have three submitters registered. The first one is Mari Day. Please come forward, and if you could start with your name and address for the record, so we can understand how this might impact you.
My name is Marie. I live at 28 Kemblawara Road, Warrawong. Okay. I have no problems with the multi-dwellings being on the 18-metre width that applies to the part of the site. I have a problem with Unit 5. The applicant states that there are no site constraints that would prevent the proposal. I disagree. Overlooking and visual aspects have not been taken into effect of the setback. I have concerns about Unit 5 that should not be there. Non-compliant and not enough time to get a planner to go over it. It is on a 9.11 metre where it should be 18. It is impacting having on us with the house we intend to build. I have supplied a copy to the council of the home we are building at the back, not yet submitted. Driving into my property is high brick dwellings both right and left. Again, I have no problems with multi-dwellings on the 18 metres. And if there is the fifth unit, it is fine. There would not be any problems. I'll drive to my new home and it's beautiful. The fifth unit is causing issues to us, overlooking, overshadowing, noise, causing anxious and stress over all of this. Lounge, dining and kitchen areas, also looking into open spaces, is not going to be comfortable to our new house. I spend a lot of time in the kitchen and the lounge room. The changes to the new plans of the units are made worse putting sliding doors instead of windows in the bottom bedroom that look straight into our lounge room, dining and kitchen all the time in my kitchen looking into their personal open space. That's our new house that we're submitting to the council. Unit 5 should not be there. Their dining room window also looking straight at us. Fence height does not reduce the overlooking on both sides and should be higher. Also stated by the applicant, I disagree. Fence heights need to be higher by stepping up on a sloping block. Page 40 on the plan shows turning bays in the deep soil, and on another page showing turning bays in Unit 6 in the visiting parking. So I just wanted to address those things because I haven't had someone to go over it. So there's just a few variations in the property as well as the unit next to us. How can someone use the turning bay when it's a visitor's parking? Seeking a variation is not fair to us that they are asking. Everyone should comply to 80 metres wide. It is going to impact us on our family and friends' privacy. Front house we live in now is all done up, comfortable for tenants when we move into our new home. Lots of privacy, double garage, car park to make it comfortable for all. Fence heights higher already at the front due to noise and overlooking, approved by all other parties. Visual amenities of personal open spaces has not been considered at the new house we are building. 1.5 of shrubs is not completely a noise barrier, as stated. Two parking allocations are also in turning bays. So they're just my comments. Thank you.
Thank you. Can I ask a question? You mentioned your new house.
Yes.
Has that been? Do you have an approval for that?
Is we have approved, no. Right? We don't have an approval as okay. yet. It has been. It's with the engineer and Bassus and everything like that to submit.
Have you made an application to the council?
No. Okay. No. It's ready to. It's just about ready to go to the council. Probably in the next 4 weeks, if so.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
That's good.
Do you have a question, Steve?
Marie,
yes.
Your new house. Your current house is at the front of the block?
Yes. Yes.
So the new house is at the rear?
Yes.
Quite a long block.
Yes, that's correct.
No other questions? Thank you very much. The next speaker is Ronaldo Mehta. Thank you. If you'd start with your address, please.
Hello to the panel. I live at 28 Kembawara Road, Kembawara. My name is Ronaldo Mehta. I own number 28 for about 23 years. I have lived there for 6 years now, waiting to build my new home. I have no problem with the multi-well buildings being built. Well, my main concern is the Unit 5 being in the non-compliance zone. My plans are now being put together for my new house. My main concern is that the fences have to be higher for privacy. My other concern is that the number 5 will be looking into my kitchen, lounge room and dining room, so it's into my privacy area. This will cause overlooking, values aspects as shadowing and noise that need to be considered on both sides. The unit 5 does not comply because it only has 9.11 metres wide. It should be 18 metres. And half of the unit is in the non-compliance zone. I have spent a lot of money at my house now so that someone can be comfortable living there. When I am in my new home, I will always... I spend a lot of money there, so when I'm in my new home, they're also comfortable. I'm always trying to make it better for all. The need to add more privacy to the side of my front house due to overlooking from balconies. I would like more time to overlooking issues being addressed at Unit 5. Unit 5 should be taken away or to be reduced so that less impact on my new home because of privacy concerns. This unit is in a non-compliance zone. A variation should not be accepted, and there is not enough consideration to my house at the back being built. That's all.
Thank you. Same question. You mentioned a new house that you're building.
Yep.
Has that been approved by the council?
And it's in the process. We're just about to put it inside the council. That's what it is.
Okay. So you haven't actually made the application?
We're almost ready. We're just weeks away from doing it.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
The next speaker is John Metter. Again, if you can start with your address, please. Thank you.
My name is John Metter. I'm representing Giovanni Metter, which is my father. I live with my dad at number 26 Kimblewara Road, Warong. And the problem with this is there's a lot of... Where we are, all our balconies face this dwelling. Now, by us looking into their private open spaces... doesn't make it much good. So they have a view now. Our tenants, where our building is now, have a view now. By this going up, there won't be any views, nor of the lake, nothing. All you're going to be looking at is walls that are coming there. Now, the tenants there will obviously feel enclosed, and by us not having this unit at the back. Obviously, it's 18 metres wide to have multi-dwelling. This thing's 9 metres wide. You can't have in 9 metres wide. I mean, now there's rules to follow, and I don't understand why we should be bending the rules. We can make amendments, but not by bending the rules. Now, with this Unit 5 being there, these units are my father's only income. He is governed by rents on his units, and the tenants feel that they will be looking down directly into these people's private open spaces, and by them, vice versa, will be looking directly up at where my father's units are. And like I said, that'll obviously would impact his livelihood because he doesn't receive a pension because he has the units there, and they're his only source of income for them. So I'm only asking the panel to take consideration both sides and for you to make a decision of what you think is a good decision.
Thank you.
No worries.
That's all the speakers I have registered, people who made submissions. Is there anyone else here who didn't register who wishes to speak tonight? No? Okay. Well, I have registered Christy Patouklias, town planner representing the applicant. So if you'd like to come to the table, now you have 5 minutes if you were going to present. Our expectation, as I mentioned earlier, is that the panel would like to hear your responses to the concerns that have been raised tonight.
Yep.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to speak, and it was good to hear from the surrounding residents in terms of the concerns that they've noted. Essentially, the key issues from listening to the residents and reviewing the objections in relation to this development relate to overlooking and privacy, view loss, essentially is what we've heard tonight, and also in some of the submissions, parking, noise, overshadowing, and the character of the development. In terms of overlooking and privacy setbacks, the majority of those concerns arise from the adjoining neighbours to the east of the site, and the relationship between the adjoining dwellings, the adjoining dwelling and the existing residential flat building. Essentially, the proposal has been designed, and a lot of concerns in relation to Unit 5, so it might be a good chance to start with that. Essentially, if you're looking at the floor plans of the at first floor level of Unit 5, there are two bedrooms at first floor level, and the robes are situated along the eastern elevation, and so there are no windows in any of those bedrooms. However, there are high-level windows just above the stair and outside of the bathroom at first floor level. So I guess in terms of concerns from privacy and overlooking, there's very limited opportunity for that to occur, and there's a reasonable setback in that location. The residents at 28 had also raised concerns at ground floor level of the relationship between the development. I'm not sure whether some of those concerns may be resolved if we come to agreement in terms of potential height of fencing or privacy screens along that boundary, and that's certainly something that we would be open to consider, because it's unlikely that there would be any privacy issues taking into account there's a 1.8 metre fence going along that boundary. In terms of the turning bay and visitor parking, there are two designated visitor parking spaces, and there's also a dedicated turning bay, just to ensure that there's no conflicts in that regard. The second objector, Ronaldo, also raised concerns about the fence height, but I'm not sure what would be an appropriate fence height, and again, be very open to consider privacy screening or, to take into account the height of the fencing that the residents would like to see along that boundary. In terms of overlooking from the ground floor kitchen, lounge and dining, there is a 1.5 metre landscape buffer along that location, and as I said, it probably comes down to fencing in that regard, but it's unlikely that there's going to be any potential for overlooking given that's at ground floor level. The third submission or objector, John, raised concern about the relationship between the development and the existing residential flat building to the east, and the fact that a lot of the balconies have views over the development site. Essentially, the proposal will change the dynamics to some extent, but I guess it just reiterating that the proposal is well within the height controls, is well below the 9 metre height limit, and it's well within the FSR. Taking into account the pictures that have been provided in terms of view impacts, it's unlikely that the proposal will have a significant impact in terms of the views from the living areas of the development, and in summary, substantial design changes are not considered to be warranted in that regard to address those issues. So that's essentially my summation, and if there's any questions, I'm happy to take those on board from the panel.
Thank you. Yeah, I think we have a few questions.
Sure.
I'll lead off. One of the submitters made some commentary about the Turning Bay being within the deep soil zone and the visitors' spaces being, or Turning Bay being in the visitors' spaces or vice versa. What's your response to that? I'm looking at the site plan.
Yep. Yeah, I'm looking at the site plan as well, and the Turning Bay is outside of the area that's been... The dedicated Turning Bay that adjoins Unit 6 is located outside of the deep soil area, and then there are two visitor parking spaces that adjoin Units 4 and Unit 2. And all of those spaces sit outside of the deep soil area.
Okay, and those visitor spaces aren't required for turning?
No.
Okay. Larissa?
Questions? Thank you for your presentation. Can I ask you, I've got a survey. Do you know the height of the flats to the west, which is number 34? So number 34, Kemblawarra Road. I've got a survey with no height of the
unfortunately,
ridge.
Unfortunately, it's not indicated on the survey, no.
Yeah, you don't have a height.
No.
Okay, I wanted to check
the
relative heights of that building to what you're proposing.
Yeah.
Okay. Second question is back to kind of a bit of the philosophy around your design.
Yep.
So I've noticed... on the eastern side, you've placed your private areas of private open space to kind of provide greater separation from that boundary. But along the western side, you've provided those... There's two.
Yes.
Two areas are fine at the front for Unit 9 and Unit 6, providing more separation. But the central ones, you've positioned them centrally. Why is that? Because if they were positioned like Units 3 and 2...
Yep.
You would get better separation from those adjoining properties as well. So can you just why that couldn't be achieved, let's say, or what the...
Sure. It's probably more of a question for Jack, but when I had a look at the drawings, essentially because those courtyards are on the northeastern side of Units 7 and 8, so it's essentially just to improve solar access to those courtyards.
Can that be achieved if they were to be switched? No.
It would make it really difficult.
It'd be on the
southern
side. Right. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Steve, do you have some questions? A question from me. The rear of the site appears to have been filled at some stage.
Yep.
And I'm just wondering, I haven't seen any investigation into potential contamination.
Nope.
I'm just wondering what investigations that you may have undertaken.
Sure. We haven't undertaken any investigations regarding contamination because the existing use is residential and we're proposing to maintain that use. It does appear that there is some fill to the rear, and I have spoken to the client about that. The fill was there before he purchased the site, and there's no information available that would indicate that the site's contaminated. So there have been no studies undertaken in relation to that.
Okay. Can you use your microphone?
There is a, when we were on site today, there's I'm not sure if it's a... someone's dumped some sump oil or something like that in the middle of the site. Quite a large, it's probably an area about 1 to 2 metres square. Again, I don't know if that's...
I think those home mechanics.
Okay. yeah, all right.
I'll probably just... just flag with you that there is a little bit of concern, and I accept that you're not changing the use.
Yep.
But you are intensifying the use quite significantly, because that part of the area which is filled is currently not used for anything.
Sure.
But clearly, once you start excavating you into that fill without knowing what's potentially there, that could be an issue. And also, you're going to have private open space and deep soil zones there as well. So I'll just flag with you that that might be a bit of an issue.
Sure.
For the panel.
Yep. If the panel requires any further investigations or studies, like a stage one, to be undertaken, we can certainly have a look at that.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions? No. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That concludes item one. People who are here for item one, you're welcome to stay for the rest of the meeting if you wish, but there's no need to, because there'll be no further discussion on your item. As I mentioned earlier, our decision will be placed on the Council's website within 3 working days. Okay, item two. Item two is presented to the panel for advice, not for determination. So process for the meeting is still the same, and the panel will still deliberate on the recommendations, but we'll be making recommendations to the council, and then the council will make the final decision. So this is for a modification to an existing consent, which is issued to Skydive the Beach. My understanding, just for some background to this before we hear from the speakers, is that the current operation is operating in accordance with a number of earlier development consents. It's not operating on in accordance with the consent issued in 2014. That consent has not been activated as yet. So if there's discrepancies between potentially what's happening now and what's being said about what's proposed to be happening, they're sort of two different things, because the 2014 consent is much clearer than the earlier consents, and in some ways it's a little more restrictive than the earlier consents as well. So, until the new consent is activated, the applicant's entitled to rely on the consents that were issued over earlier years. We have just bear with me. 5 submitters registered to speak. The first speaker is Gordon Arthur. Perhaps if you can start with your address, please.
Okay. Gordon Arthur, Pleasant Avenue, Unit 3, 628 Pleasant Avenue. My concern is that there seems to be a disconnect between the planning department and the compliance departments. As you're aware, there's a number of DAs, and there's also the licences covering operations. And the new DA appears to be a bit of a mishmash, and they're actually out of compliance, and council is aware of this, of their licence conditions. And under other businesses would probably have their licences cancelled for that. I have no trouble with them operating, but the big problem is if there's an incident that occurs and it's on the ground, the Parachute Federation and CAS have said, as long as the planes are okay and they're okay coming down, it's their fault. If they hit someone on the ground because they're not landing in the right area or there's problems on the ground, that's council's liability. So if you fall out of a plane and you kill somebody, council are the ones who get sued if they're not operating according to the council restrictions. I mean, when you, as a local, you see them every day down the beach. they're supposed to allow people when they're landing. Actually, they're landing illegally on the southern one because they don't have the right to land there. They land there, they take the entire section of that area. They don't even allow people below the high water mark, which by law they're supposed to. And they're supposed to leave a 3-metre barrier so that people can still walk through. They just do it. And, of course, they're only allowed to drop 8 people at a time. Currently, they're dropping 10. So they don't abide by the rules. So I really can't see the right of giving them unrestricted go at everything as they are talking now, because they want to reduce the number of parachute drops per flight. Technically, if you said we're going to have flights, so they can have 3 flights an hour, the council has no restrictions on the size of plane or where it's coming from or where they're dropping from, so or hours. So they could say, like, let's do an extra business thing. We'll get a 300-seater plane from Canberra, come over, drop people at 10 different levels, go up to 30,000 feet, have people in oxygen doing halo, you know, and they'll charge them $3,000 for a drop, and do this 24 hours a day. You could have people coming down continuously, and there's no restrictions, whereas before they've been said, you can do so many drops an hour, so many hours. You know, they've been told they're night drops. We've got videos of them dropping after midnight on a full moon. On their previous licences, they weren't allowed to drop at night time. So unless council actually has an enforcement situation in place where they're enforcing the rules and they're protecting the public, I don't think that we should be looking at removing the limitations on the parachute drops. And the reason they want to keep these old licences and DAs in force is that they'll still have to go to public exhibition to get the new licences. And then there might be a big fight over the fees they're paying and all sorts of things, because realistically the council's covering the maintenance costs of the grounds. If the council don't keep the grounds in good condition, they've probably got a comeback. You've given us the right to land here. We're not looking after the grounds. You're looking after the grounds. So if someone's injured on the grounds, it's council responsibility. Same as with the council landing zones. They're on their plans, they're allowed a certain area. They now take the entire park. So if you're walking around the park, they just chase everybody out, which is also another issue, because technically it is a display jump area and you should not have people within certain areas, within certain heights. So I've seen deaf kids, people, migrants, walking through the park, don't know, and they're chasing them off just as the parachutes are landing. You know, so it's not really well controlled. And as a resident, my big concern is the council is not funded for the liabilities. That, you know, it's a numbers game. People will be injured or killed eventually. And if you've got more and more people, it's going to be more frequently. So, you know, they're not covering the insurance. They're not covering the maintenance of the grounds. You know, maybe the council, if they start approving these extra drops, they should be charging like $100 a head levy or something to cover insurance and maintenance costs. So we've got lots of evidence of them not abiding by the council rules, but no one wants to know about it. The councillors are not worried about it. We've sent letters into the council members. They actually sent letters to them saying, oh, you're not doing it properly, but nothing's really happening.
Thank you.
That's 5 minutes, so yes. Do you need to sum up?
No, unless council have competent compliance people to oversee the operations, I really couldn't support removing any of these restrictions.
Okay, thank you. Just before we, you're right, call the next speaker, I just want to make it clear that the panel is considering a modification to a development consent under the Environmental Planning and Assessment Act. We're not considering the licence, the agreement, the rental, the fees, any of that, and it would be quite inappropriate for this panel to do that. That's not within our brief. That's a totally separate process. And as you mentioned, Mr. Arthur, that's a public process as well. So what is being considered is whether or not to approve the modification that's by no means the end of the story, because then the council's property people, which are the people who are charged with managing the council's property, they have to then negotiate appropriate leases and licences and conditions, and no doubt those sorts of things like insurance, I'm sure, would form, I don't know, but I'm sure would form part of that. So I just want to make it clear, I understand your point about compliance, I understand exactly what you're saying about that, but I just want to make it clear that the licensing is a totally separate process. The next speaker is Ian Young. If you can start with your address, please, Mr. Young. Sorry, what is it that you are giving us? That's going to take you a lot longer than 5 minutes. I hope that's not all your speech. Okay. Have these documents been provided to the council previously?
They are council documents.
They're council documents. Okay, thank you.
Hello, my name's Ian Young. I live at 1 Duff Parade, East Corrimal. Thank you for the opportunity to speak. In reviewing the two DAs in question, it comes to a strong opinion that the Skydive does not have a valid licence to land anywhere in Wollongong. DA 9715, I believe, is included in the licence in Dalt Park was due to Wollongong City Council copying the 1997 licence and changing the schedule without changing the condition of compliance. The licence condition should have been DA 2005473. Permission to land under 9715 ceased in 1998 at the end of the DA period of consent. Regardless of which DA, the 2005 licence was issued under Section 47A of the Local Government Act, which allows a licence, including options, a maximum period of 5 years. The current use is now 13 years and would appear to be, it's out of date. DA 2009681 was never consented in accordance with Local Government Act Section 94, 95 and 99. The determination was conditionally approved under Section 94. This is defined as a deferred consent under Section 95, and the proponent must do all things to meet the conditions before Council can give consent under S99. The condition of the determination is that Skydive was entering into a new licence to land in Stuart Park before commencing operations. They were also required to enter into a one-year licence before landing on North Beach. There are no new licences. Consequently, the DAs have lapsed in accordance with the DA notification, which had 5 years. It is also noted the assessment for 2009681, Crown Land has not been asked for, nor did it give approval for skydiving and to land in Stuart Park. In the report to the Council of 27 April, it shows the Crown Land had not given consent. The reason for the DA in the first place was Wollongong City Council wrote to Mr. Bocott on the 8th of April 2009, advising they did not have a valid DA to land in Stuart Park as the DA attached that licence had lapsed, and the condition was very serious since SDB needed to lodge a new DA urgently. Skydive acknowledged this in their EIS, and noting that the DA which is attached to that licence and continue attached to the current licence is DA 98617AM2, had lapsed and a new DA was necessary to normalise their operations. Wollongong City Council continue to advise the current licence being used to land sure is the same licence as Council advised was invalid in 2009. So effectively the 618 licence never eventuated. Well, it was advised in January this year they were not to land on North Beach, and there's a document showing that they have been told that they were, but cite that Skydive continues to land there in breach of any of the licence and conditions. False and misleading information. In the documents coming to the court, there's this one was included, which is the landing area plan of management. It contains statements which Skydive know are false and misleading. The first point is the size of landing area, which is stated as 10 metres by 10 metres. The Australian Parachute Federation minimum requirement under the regulations is 2,500 square metres with 25 metre lead in all round. Given an area of approximately 100 metres by 100 metres, which is the size of the skydive actually cordoned off, and a bit bigger than they show on their DAs. Point two was the crowd control. Skydive advised that at the time the public is excluded from the drop zone as being approximately 5 minutes. Under point five of the procedures in the POM, the area must be set up and free of people 5 minutes before parachutes are released from the plane. In other correspondence, Skydive report that parachutes take approximately 8 minutes in the air and by observation 2.5 to 3 minutes to clear the area. This is about 15 minutes the public excluded from the drop zone. For three flights an hour, allowing the extra time for Skydive to remove and replace the bollards, the public would have at best about 1 minute between flights to use the area. In reality, Skydive solved this problem by cordoning off the area in Stewart Park Oval at least 5 minutes before the first flight of the day and only opening it up after the last flight of the day, even if they are landing on another location in breach of the Dalton, as far as the beach or Dalton Park, that the public is excluded from whatever Skydive are operating. With respect to public interest, Wollongong Council staff advise Council, Crownlands and IHAB that the public interest served by there being eight flights a day, landing an area of 10 by 10, occupying an area of 10 minutes per day for a total of 80 minutes per day. This appears false and misleading. Staff know that they shouldn't be null misleading.
But that's your 5 minutes. Can you sum up quickly?
Yeah, there's two issues. The one that the information provided public interest is grossly understated, that the actualisations, and Skydive has shown they don't comply. And there's a letter from Council asking that for Crownland advice on whether it is permissible under the public interest from Crownlands, as per the letter. Adjacently speaking, Skydive haven't fulfilled their requirements under current licence conditions or DAs. Why should we?
Neither one
is valid.
You mentioned licences throughout your presentation.
Yes.
I'm not quite sure what you're actually referring to. Is it licences from civil aviation or is it...
It's council licences.
These aren't development consents.
The development consent attached to the licences.
So the licences you're referring to...
Are the licence to operate and land in Stewart Park.
Yeah, okay. Yep. So those, just as I said after the last speaker spoke, just to be clear, this panel's not considering those licences.
But I'm just saying...
This is about a particular modification. So do you have a view about what's being proposed in the modification? You haven't mentioned that.
Well, I'm happy for them to land at Dalton Park under the 2005 DA.
No, well, the question was, do you have a view about what they're now proposing in their,
yes,
in the, their modification?
Yes, both DAs are not acceptable because they're non-existent. They've both been lapsed.
Just focus for a moment.
Yep.
We're talking about previous DAs.
Yeah.
This is an application to modify a development consent that was issued in 2014.
Yeah.
A development consent that hasn't yet been activated.
Yeah. They've asked for consideration of the two DAs. Both DAs have both lapsed.
No. They're asking to modify the 2014 DA by a couple of things. They're asking for different flights per hour and different terminology, and they're also asking for... They're also asking that they not surrender some of the previous consents. What I'm concerned about, what I want to hear from you is, we're restricted as a panel to consider
that
application to modify those conditions.
Yep.
And I'd like to hear from you very quickly whether you have a view on that or not.
Well, on the two DAs that they want to retain, neither of them are valid. They're both lapsed. And they don't. It's the one for.
So that modification doesn't concern you because those consents have lapsed. So what about the other?
The number of flights per day, unlimited flights per day, will leave the oval effectively fully booked out by Skydive when they're in their operation. The public does not get any consideration to it as defined within the DA when they present the DA. But they said public is only excluded for 80 minutes a day. They're in fact excluded all day.
So you're concerned that if there was unrestricted flights or unrestricted numbers,
yeah,
that the public wouldn't get a look in on this part of the park?
Public don't get a look in now.
Okay. All right. Thank you for that.
Thank you.
The next speaker is Philip Laird. Thank you. If you can start with your address, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the panel. My name is Philip Laird, and I reside at Brayside Avenue, Kirriville. I'm speaking as one who made a submission to council and appeared before the IHAP panel in the December 2016, and I support the view of what's been before us of Neighbourhood Forum 5. And I suggest, whilst it was good to see Skydive doing well, their ongoing operation should not be at the expense of the alienation of public land at Stewart Park. Now, although use of Stewart Park might have been acceptable while they're ramping up the business, I think it's gone on for too long now. And the extent of use with the frequency of skydiving, along with the increasing population of the city and the number of people using this park from the city and also from other local government areas for passive recreation, I think if the council stuck with the 2014 consent, then there should be no relaxation of the conditions already granted. In fact, we should be going back to the conditions imposed by the first IHAP panel, which were watered down by the second IHAP panel. You know, I think we have an unacceptable situation here, and I think it's made worse by the very low fees that are paid. And although I note that, you know, it's outside your terms of reference, it certainly is a ratepayer and a resident galling to see so little return for a dubious use of public land. I refer you to two points. Skydive the Beach, in its initial public offering prospectus, provided information on the licence to Skydive Holdings from Port Phillip Council for the St Kilda. There it worked out the fees are $27 per drop, and this would probably cover maintenance and other things of their park. Here, Wollongong City Council in that year of 2014 was receiving about 42 cents per jump. The second point is the Blue Mountain City Council, in considering, you know, use of land and sky space, sought the advice of the Valuer General, who felt that 5 to 7% of the gross annual revenue from ticket sales for a Skyway ride would be reasonable. If we took 6% of the income disclosed by the applicant in the initial public offering prospectus, we would have had a revenue of about $315,000 a year, which is appreciably below the St Kilda rate. So what we're getting is really the bottom of the barrel. And, you know, they really should be, I think the current, you know, if the consent needs to be modified, if it can indeed be modified, it should be going back to the IHAP panel 1 recommendations, which were 3-1, IHAP 2, the applicant at the hearing asked for concessions, and they were granted before the objectors could even respond to the applicant's new claim for, you know, strike out this condition one. So, and I think if the council wants to be lenient, it should not be at Stuart Park. Yes, you could perhaps have a scope for leniency at Dalton Park, which is a more suited in many ways. But Stuart Park, as the city grows, as the urban density grows near Stuart Park, it's not a good look for the state of New South Wales, or I would suggest for Australia. You know, we are, you know, Wollongong's the 10th largest city in Australia. We should be doing better. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Laird.
I'd be happy to try and take any questions that you may.
We have any questions? No.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Again, I'll reiterate that this panel's role is not to consider licence fees or licensing, and indeed, my understanding is that the 2014 development consent will be the trigger for the relevant council people to negotiate a new lease on current terms with the operators. The next speaker is Ray Robinson. Is this information that's been provided to the council? What sort of information is it, can I ask? Clarifying what? Okay. Thank you.
Okay, I'm Ray Robinson from 5 Payne Road, East Corrimal, and I'm speaking on behalf of Protect Our Parks Incorporated. And I'll just walk through what I've put before you today is, like the previous three speakers, we don't object to the skydive. We support the business in Wollongong, however, not at the cost of public interest. We have lobbied and asked for a transfer to the Dalton Park over the years, and council has avoided it. And there was no cost-benefit analysis shown to the public as to why they would choose to interfere with the public interest in Stuart Park. And as has been commented on, Dalton Park is very appropriate and to develop. Going further down in the points here on the first page, in the report, it was talking about this modification was not in the public interest. Well, that's not right. Any modification on this particular business on public land has an interest in the public, or the public has an interest in it. And so that's important to note. When these modifications are a dangerous precedent, because as you have, Mr. Chair, identified a couple of times, you are constrained, but we, the public, cannot accept that. This constraint on the panel is too, demeaning to the public, right? This is probably one of the few options we have to speak out, and so we have the right, we look for the right to speak our mind, and based on fact. And the submission that Poppy made, the Protect Our Parks, was indeed very thorough, as the other speakers have spoken, in terms of following through the trail of what's been occurring. And it's not looking good in the terms of the public interest. And just seconding Philip Laird's point, the dissenting view back in 2015, January 2015, was by, you had on the panel, a dissenting view by an urban planning expert didn't agree with the deletion of the daylight hours and the drops per day. That was deleted out of it against the advice of one of your members. Then on the last paragraph there's three points that were not included in this report. So why were they left out? I want to concur with the zoning area, the drop area. Under the parachute federation requirements, it's much larger, 100 times larger, I think it is. Yeah, 100 times larger than what they are using. How can this happen in our town, that this non-compliance occurs? We did a GIPA request and have found out from the council that 96% of the days are used by the skydive. So where's the public interest in that? Okay, and so the final point I want to make down there at the bottom of page 2 is we want this constraint reinstated, right? How can a regulator like council say we won't put a constraint on something so hazardous and contravening public interest and not put a constraint on it? How sad is that? Reestablish it in terms of daylight hours, returning maximum drops restricted to 28 and 19,000 a year.
Thank you. Can I ask you if you have a view on the modification that's before the panel?
My understanding is that is the modification. Pardon my ignorance.
Well,
the modification is about the drops, and we say no.
Well, you haven't really said anything about the modification. You've given us a history, and you want us to go back to a previous consent, which is no longer... we don't have the power to do that.
That doesn't allow you to investigate the panel. With respect, Mr. Chair, it doesn't allow you to, follow the trail. And so we are saying here that this modification, taking the cap off, and I said that, taking the cap off the drops is ridiculous, absolutely ridiculous, for a regulator to take the cap off. Now, am I misreading the plan?
I must have misheard. I didn't hear you say that.
Because
the critical thing is that all this other information is good for background, but the reality is, as a panel making a decision and taking into account the public's concerns, we need to hear what you think about the actual application that
When I said reinstate that which was happened before, reinstate...
We can't do that, but we have to... consider the application that's in front of
us. Well,
and it's important that we know what your issue is about that.
The implication is that's a ridiculous position for a council not to put a regulation, a cap on it. And in terms of the operational plan of management not being displayed or authorised, whatever, is again ridiculous in terms of the requirements, the safety requirements by the parachute people, the Federation. So, by all means,
I think it has to be. Can I just ask, have you read the planning report?
The what?
The planning report that's gone up for tonight's meeting.
77 pages of it?
I don't know if it's that long, but the planning report. The planning report we've got
I scanned it.
It's 30, but that's included.
We'll just take the essentials.
Yeah. So what I wanted to ask is the recommendation before the IHAP today is the council have agreed that an unlimited amount is not acceptable, so they have capped. Capped the condition.
The copy I saw, it was they recommended it.
They have capped it. They've distributed the drops obviously differently, but it's not increasing the number of drops. So they have changed the condition but kept it in the same context as the original IHAP condition, and they have also proposed to restructure and have the operational plan of management on display, but not physically, in a different context. It's displayed on the window, it's made public. So my understanding is they have acknowledged that there's problems with the operation, and removing those conditions in their entirety is not acceptable. But whether we agree with that recommendation is another story. But I just wanted to kind of highlight that they were the recommendations. The council did consider the unlimited drops and did place restrictions on those. They didn't agree with the applicant in the unlimited. So the report does discuss those conditions and rewords them. So that's what I just wanted to say. It might be value just to read that report and see what council have suggested, because they're certainly not requesting or agreeing to an unlimited amount of drops.
Those conditions have been reworded. I'll go and get that article off the screen. Well done.
So you know, the recommendation of the council staff to us is that the condition be amended to read, there shall be a maximum of 3 flights per hour from which parachutes are dropped. So it's not quite what you would like to see, I don't think.
No, it's not. That's the inference.
Sorry, what's the council? Bear with me.
No?
Did you recommend?
Sorry.
Is this a question through the report stands for itself. We recommended amendments.
Yeah. Let's have a look. Thank you. I just want to be clear on this because...
Yeah, thank you.
There shall be a maximum of 3 flights per hour from which parachutes are dropped, and a maximum of 24 parachutes dropped per hour. So that's what the recommendation that we have in front of us is. So the applicants asked for it being unrestricted. The council staff have considered that and considered all of the submissions received. And the council staff have said, well, no, you can have 3 flights per hour. With a maximum of 24 dropped per hour, parachutes dropped per hour, which is essentially not much the same intensity as the condition that was the original condition. Now, as Larissa said, we may or may not accept that that draft condition, and I'm sure the applicant's going to have something to say to us about it tonight. But that is the council officer's recommendation to us, and I think where that's come from is that the terminology of the existing condition is a little bit unclear because it talks about drops, whereas this is clearer in that it says flights, 3 flights an hour, and a maximum of 24 parachutes dropped.
Well, clearly, we would support that. But, on the first page, that's what I was recommendation. This is what I was reading. It is recommended that aspects of the application be approved. The draft is...
Yeah.
So if you go to the top, you go to page 4.
Yeah, that's what Mike's... Yeah.
The first paragraph there in italics.
Are the other people that spoke understanding following
us?
Yeah,
wow.
We're learning.
You're learning? Okay, you must have missed that somehow.
Yeah.
It is.
That was my question.
Mr. Robinson, if there was to be sharing of the park, or if parachutes were to be allowed, in any given hour, what I don't know if Poppy has a view about this or not, but what would the group see as a maximum number of, if you like, minutes in any hour that Skydive the Beach could use the park, a portion of the park. Is there a consensus on that?
From my, I can't speak on behalf of the group.
Okay.
In terms of the failure to do a cost-benefit analysis between Struer Park and Dalton Park would put me in a position where not in a good place, right, in terms of the public interest, you know, and in terms of the environment as well, yeah. Right?
I guess I'm getting at, wrapping some time in an hour that they use a portion of the park. And, is there a view around is 15 minutes? Sorry.
Is 15 minutes acceptable, or is that not acceptable, or is...
The rationale, one would think, is how inconvenient for the recreational people to run in and out of the space, of the oval. So the only logic explanation that comes to mind is the mornings are for the parachutists, the afternoons are for the passive recreation. You know, that way there is a clear delineation of who can be using it, right? There's not a confusion going on, particularly with strangers coming into the area.
Okay. Yeah.
I apologise, Mr. Chair, for the misunderstanding.
No, don't apologise. we're here to obviously get to the bottom of everything and make sure that whatever decision the panel makes is based on the correct information. So I thank you for that discussion. So are you registered to speak? You have spoken. Well, we've got one more speaker registered. We'll hear from that speaker, and then we'll allow you to make a comment. Elizabeth Keenan.
My name is Elizabeth Keenan and I live at 7 Borodoul Street, Kerrville. Kerrville is my home of 27 years, 5 kilometres from Struer Park and 20 kilometres from Albion Park Airport. Kerrville's latitude and longitude coordinates and those of my house align almost exactly with daily flight path coordinates of Skydive the Beach's planes. Significant negative impacts on my life are caused by the increasing number, frequency and noise of the airplanes and parachutists. In the last week, for example, family meals and time spent as home-based activities were intruded on by the whir of the plane, forth back. I play tennis on Friday, parachutists every 20 minutes above us. We can see and hear them so they can see and hear us. I'm a teacher. The drone of the plane permeates the playground. A friend's son was married in his parents' back garden last Saturday, the vows punctuated by the flumph of uninvited parachute canopies opening above them. Though I speak for myself, my discomfort is shared by others. Many who know the iconic Aussie film The Castle, which was recently voted as the best motive of who we are as a nation because it has as its core message the quest for a fair go, all the Kerrigan family wants is to enjoy the serenity of their home. There are parallels between the film and the battle over Skydive's application for almost total unrestricted use of public parklands and indeed the very sunshine and the air above this city. I feel our serenity is being eroded. The Kerrigans happily coexist with the airport next door until one day, due to its expansion, they are faced with compulsory acquisition and eviction. The film seriously champions the law that property can only be taken on just terms with just compensation and that the individual's rights are as important as those of an ambitious company and government. It's fair to say that many people in the Illawarra, myself included, acknowledge Skydive's successes and have been happy to coexist, sharing the use of the public parklands when there was only periodic exclusion and minor interruption to other people's serenity in the suburbs. That has changed now. With virtual total exclusion or eviction from the parklands and the expanded flights, parachutists and the increasing incidental infringement of others' privacy in an urban environment. Skydive seems only content to share when conditions are not suitable for skydiving. Optimal conditions for skydiving are also optimal conditions for everyone else's enjoyment, be it in Stewart Park or my back garden. So how can it be just to make a ruling that one company gets to utilise the best sunshine and the rest of the community can leave, have the leftovers? In its letter of the 5th of July, 2018, MMJ claims its client Skydive has conceded to the restriction of 3 flights per hour. I am not impressed by this as a concession because it would be difficult to fit more than 3 flights in per hour unless it does so by conducting 3 additional flights using the second plane at the same time. I request that further clarification be sought re the definition of a flight. The FlightAware tracking internet site records the plane only made 1 flight on last Saturday, the 28th of the 7th, between takeoff at 8:41 in the morning and landing at 14:40 in the afternoon. Yet when one looks at the flight log graph, the plane made 11 liftoffs and setdowns. Are these liftoffs what Skydive the Beach may term loads? MMJ claims that if Skydive is allowed to increase the number of parachuters, this may mean less hours of operation. It is already dropping more parachuters in the new planes than it did in the older, smaller planes, but I detect no shortening of hours of operation. Nor does this claim seem credible while the company is simultaneously requesting unrestricted hours of operation, including night drops. That Skydive has spent a deal of money on 2 bigger planes is presumptuous of an as-yet-to-be-decided outcome. Finally, the Cairns Post reports that the inquest into the October tragedy at the company's Mission Beach site begins this month. The findings may have no bearing on the company's operational management at the other 17 sites, including this one. But what if they do? Will it mean back to the drawing board? To conclude, I reference the castle again. When the judge asks, on what law are you basing your argument on, Darrell Kerrigan answers, the law of bloody common sense, which leads to restored serenity. I therefore respectfully request that the panel does not support any of the proposed modifications. If it does allow more parachutists per load, then there must be restrictions on the hours of operation to guarantee a fair share of the sunshine and the serenity for the wider community. And may I also add a request to consider, Skydive to consider, alternating or alternative flight paths. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions from the panel? No. Thank you very much. That concludes the registered speakers. Is there anybody else who wishes to speak as a submitter that didn't register? No. Gentleman over here, Mr. Young, you had a question for me? So you're reiterating what you said, that they're not complying at the moment? Okay. Okay, thank you. Okay, we have... on behalf of the applicant, Luke Rollinson and Anthony Ritter. Gentlemen, you have 5 minutes each if you wish to present.
Present first, if that's all
right. Sorry?
I can present first. If
yes,
that's all
certainly. Right. However, we do expect that you'll have some responses to the submissions made, and no doubt we'll have some questions for you. So. Just bear with us that the panel may give the applicant a little more time than you had individually, but it's important to hear their responses to the concerns that you raised. Please proceed.
Yeah, great. Thanks for your time this evening. Just to confirm, Anthony Ritter is my name. I'm the Chief Executive Officer and Director of Skydive Holdings, the applicant. Also Skydive the Beach, also Experience Co Limited, which is the parent company. I do have the authority to be here tonight and comment on behalf of the company. I do have a couple of comments to obviously go through, but I'd like just to start off with a few replies to the five previous speakers, Mr. Arthur, Mr. Young, Mr. Laird, Mr. Robinson and Ms. Keenan. The panel indicated that we're here to talk about the three modification of conditions proposed, and I will address that shortly. One comment that Mr. Arthur did make troubled me, and I just wanted to be on the public record that he did indicate that council's not funded for any insurance liability, and I wanted it noted publicly that we do hold an insurance policy with Wollongong Council noted, so there is adequate protection there for Wollongong Council. Just wanted to clear that matter. I'd like to read. There's three dot points on page one of the assessment report and recommendation. The first modification relates to conditions 3I and 58, and I'd like to just read a letter regarding that. And I'd like to then hand the letter to the panel. I refer to the proposal for the modification of DA 2014-306 and hereby request that the proposal to modify conditions 3I and 58 to limit the number of flights rather than drops and to remove the limitation imposed on maximum number of parachute drops per flight be removed from tonight's assessment. It is not our intent to increase the intensity or usage of the park, but to utilise the full capacity of our aircraft in order to drop 30 parachutes per hour. I note that our existing aircraft can take 10 tandem customers per flight movement, of which we currently do up to 3 flights an hour. Increasing from 8 tandem customers to 10 tandem customers per flight movement does not increase the intensity or usage of the park any further. We intend on submitting a separate Section 96 application for this specific modification at a later date. I can pass that to you now. The panel's happy. I'll continue with my speech with regards to the other two conditions.
I might just explain this. Okay, so as people are aware, there's three proposed or modifications, three areas to propose to modify. The one that seems to have been causing the most angst is the restriction on the number of flights, drops, whatever we call them. This is a formal amendment to the applicant's modification to no longer pursue that part of their modification. So normally with a development application, normally the panel would probably not accept late information, but given that this is, it's not new plans, it's not particularly new information, it's just a straight amendment to the modification application that doesn't raise any new issues, and probably puts some of the concerns aside that were raised tonight, then I'm, as the chairman of the panel, prepared to accept this on behalf of the council. And what that means is that there'll be no the advice to the council we won't be advising the council, nor will the council be approving a modification to either conditions 3 or 58. Now the applicants indicated they might come back at a later stage with that, and they're entitled to do that, but for the purposes of tonight, they've decided for whatever reason to remove that from their application. So just before they go on, Mr. Robinson, you have a question. If anyone has any questions, because I just want to be clear about this process, because, you know, we need to be clear and transparent about exactly what's happening. Mr. Robinson. Yes, please, if you wouldn't mind. And I might, given that Mr. Robinson represents an organisation, I'll give him a copy of the letter as well.
Thank you. Just a question. So one, thank you for that. When do we expect the redraft? Is that, you know, is that coming up ASAP? Is that coming 1 month later? When can we expect it?
Good question, and I'll ask the applicant to address that. I'm sure they will anyway. I'll ask them to address that. Just before they move on, is there any other questions about what questions just happened with this modification? Everyone clear on what it is that's happening? Yes? Nodding heads? Thank you. Well, they might be. Certainly the indication was, the question was, are they kicking the can down the road? And I think I understand what you mean by that. They're not dealing with it now, but they might deal with it later. And I think that may well be their intention. Okay. Thanks. Pierre, can you just give that copy to Mr. Robinson, please? Given that he represents a number of people, I think that's a reasonable thing to do. And he's sitting beside two other speakers too, so they can look over his shoulder. Okay. Mr. Ritter.
Continue.
Yes, please.
Thank you. So in relation to the remaining two conditions that were proposed to be modified, modify condition 8 to remove references to DA 2009/681 and DA 1997/15 with regard to the surrender of these consents prior to the issue of occupation certificate. Starting with DA 1997/15, we disagree with council's proposal not to change the condition, as we believe this is not relevant to the Stuart Park drop zone. Accordingly, we maintain this should not be surrendered. In relation to DA 2009/681, the advice from our planners and lawyers is to again keep this DA separate, as again this is not just relevant to the Stuart Park drop zone. We appreciate in this instance Council's proposal to amend Condition 62 with relation to the beach landings. However, we maintain our position that these be kept separate and this DA should not be surrendered.
Okay, thank you.
If I can, if I'm happy to continue for the third modification. Sure. To modify condition 10 as to remove the requirement for the operational plan and management to be physically displayed internally and externally to the building. We thank Council for their proposed change to the condition, and we accept all of Council's proposals with the exception of two dot points. Council has asked that the external wall signage contain details about the maximum number of parachutes per given time period, and Council has also asked that the external wall signage detail mechanisms for making complaints. Given the modifications to set conditions 3.I and 58, as mentioned previously, will now be addressed in a separate Section 96 application, we do not deem this point relevant at this time, and we ask the panel and council consider not imposing this requirement. Secondly, a mechanism for making complaints has been proposed to be included on that external wall. We maintain that the current mechanism for making complaints continue, and therefore this does not need to be displayed. Currently, Wollongong Council advise us if there are any complaints, which we deal with appropriately and accordingly. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Ritter? Mr. Rawlings.
I think most of the questions asked tonight are fairly operational questions, which I think Anthony's covered off on. If I was to go back over the speakers, respectfully, the majority of issues raised aren't really relevant to the subject section 96 or the subject section 4.55. They are then also dealt with by us withdrawing that parachute component or any modification to condition 3, 1 and 58. So if probably best if the panel has any particular questions that are relevant that we should answer, then happy to do that. But from a planning perspective, I'm here and Anthony's more here for the operationals.
Thank you. Any questions?
Yes. Just out of curiosity, obviously you've heard the objectors, and many of them have raised that a lot of the DAs have lapsed or you don't have can you cite the DA that you're currently operating under? Just out of curiosity, I know it's not really relevant to this, but just as
there's varying DAs that they operate under, but the two main ones would be, or the main one relevant for this one is 2009-681, which is one of the ones that we've asked not to be surrendered on the basis that that also deals with beach landings outside this lot and DP and outside the original proposal. But that's their main operational one, as I understand, for Stuart Park at the moment. I can't give a comment on licences or leases. Yeah.
Thank you. We're not having a discussion about it. The question was specifically to the applicant. Well, with respect, that's a matter for the applicant and the council. So, the question that Mr. Robertson raised about when are we likely to see, or when is the council likely to see a request for modification to the number of flights, jumps, parachutes, whatever?
I can certainly answer that, Mr. Chair. We haven't put a date on that. We received this assessment report 7 days ago, as did the community via the council website. So we will take a bit of time just to reassess that, discuss with our planners, our lawyers, and then appropriately lodge an application when we believe it's right.
Thank you. And of course, this process will occur when that further modification comes in. I'm sure the council would ask the panel for advice again. It's likely to happen. Now, normally we don't have an ability for questions, but I will allow you to ask one question, sir, very quickly.
Yeah.
Question to me, not to the applicant.
You, Mr. Chairman, the council proposal, as I understand it, was a maximum of 24 drops per hour parachutes per hour. Is that correct?
Well, that's what the recommendation was.
Yep.
But of course, that's now not relevant because the applicant's withdrawn that part of their application.
Well, we could still have a maximum of 24. Parachutes falling out of the sky an hour, and we might have less frequent flights.
There's now no change proposed to the condition as it sits in the 2014 consent. Thanks, Pierre. Okay, well, that concludes item two. Thank you for your attendance. As I mentioned, the panel's advice will be published on the council's website within 3 working days. Item three is a matter which is put before the panel for decision, 178 to 180 Lawrence Hargrove Drive, Thirroul. I have 10 speakers, submitters, and I believe that the 2, 4, 6, 7, first seven have organised themselves to speak on different matters, so we won't be hearing a repeat of the same thing. Is that right? Information correct? Well, let me say the panel really appreciates that because it helps the process along in a far better way than people just getting up and repeating something that's been said. If, by the way, you are speaking or you're not part of the group that's got together beforehand and someone has said something before you that you were going to say, I'm quite happy for you to say, yes, I agree and support what they said, and these are the other things that I'd like to say. And that, again, that just helps the process. So, Jane Bunting. Thank you. And I'll ask you to start with your address, please. and speak up nice and loud.
Okay. Good evening. My name is Jane Bunting and I reside at 182 Lawrence Hargrave Drive, which is on the southern border of the proposed development. I live there with my family, in my family home, with my husband and two children. I'd like to start by stating very clearly that I welcome the demolition of the two old buildings, hopefully before they fall down on their own, and replace with something that complies with all the rules of development. I've raised several concerns regarding the proposed development in writing at each time the proposal was on public display. This evening I'm going to focus on the retaining wall, the landfill and the overshadowing. The retaining wall between our property and 180 Lawrence Hargrave Drive was erected to contain the soil that was slipping from 180 onto our property. A letter from council was actually written to the previous owners about the need for retaining the land in 2012. This retaining wall was finally constructed in 2017. It is a wooden structure. Also to note, according to the assessment report that was put out for this evening, the final occupation certificate has not as yet been presented to council. I've read the engineer's report that accompanied the DA, which states that the wall is satisfactory for intended use and so long as no additional pressure be exerted upon it. I've also read that the piers would be such as to not add any weight onto the wall along the along with the driveway, but was the removal of the old retaining wall between 178 and 180 taken into consideration? Also the fact that all of the machinery and building supplies would inevitably be adding weight and pressure whilst the project was being constructed. Another major issue I have with the wall is the fact that it is wooden. The longevity of a wooden retaining wall is approximately 15 years. Considering that the wall is under constant pressure, being at the bottom of Kennedy's Hill, and that it is always damp due to the constant downward flow of water to get to Kelly's Creek and natural waterway, maybe even less than 15 years. So what happens when it fails? It is not a joint wall. It is completely within the boundary of 180 Lawrence Hargrave Drive. So how exactly would it be repaired or replaced? Would their driveway need to be completely removed in order to gain access? Would the building then need to be underpinned? What damage could we expect at 182? A major undertaking indeed. In a worst-case outcome, the building and land could end up on our property. It is no secret that the entire of Kennedy's Hill is moving downhill. Just look at the other supposed retaining walls uphill from us. They're all moving downhill. This leads on to the fill that the retaining wall is retaining. I've read the engineer's report regarding the sample holes and their contents. I noticed that the vast amounts of asbestos that the land indeed contains was not in the report. I, along with the builders of the wall, my family and neighbours, have all seen the asbestos seams personally. When the retaining wall was being constructed, approximately 350 to 400 kilos of asbestos was removed from the boundary line alone. I understand that the land, of course, can be remediated, but there seems to be no provision for this in the current DA. This development was also carried out by Develop My Land, so I feel that the remediation plans should have been presented to council. The seams of asbestos were 1.5 metres down and possibly further. If the land is to be developed, then the asbestos would not remain buried. There is a lot of fill on 178, which was not accessed for the report. There was once a swimming pool on the property, but I was told by the then owners that it had started sloping downhill, so it was filled with all sorts of rubbish, including a few TVs. So this would further necessitate the need for remediation. At present, the retaining wall is already showing signs of pressure by way of bowing and splitting, not in a large way, but it hasn't been there for a full year as yet. I have great concerns not only for the physical damage that could be caused to my property, but the environmental one of the asbestos contaminating my land and all those along the Kelly's Creek route to Thurl Beach. My final point is the overshadowing of our property by the sheer bulk and scale of the DA. We've recently replaced our roof and are looking at putting solar tiles on it. The fact that our home and the entire backyard would be in shadow for the most of winter is very concerning and would affect the productivity of our solar. Our fruit trees, vegetable patches, chickens and even the grass all rely on sunlight to grow and remain healthy. Without it, our plants would die, our chickens would not lay eggs and our grass would fill with weeds. Mould would sprout through our chicken pen, causing respiratory illness, and our lifestyle would suffer greatly. In conclusion, I would like to reiterate that retaining wall has caused and continues to cause a great deal of stress to our family, as does the landfill in which it retains. This stress has been exacerbated tenfold with this current DA. I feel that the DA in its current form would pose a real physical threat to our property and possibly our lives by way of the retaining wall failing or needing to be replaced and thus uncovering the asbestos yet again. The sheer bulk and scale of the DA in its current form would cause significant overshadowing, enough to interfere with our daily lives. As stated at the beginning, I'm not opposed to development. I just ask that it meets all plans, policies and other stipulations required. Just play by the rules. I thank you for your time and state that I fully agree with the Council's recommendation that DA 2017-1316 be determined by way of refusal.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Are there any questions? You're next door on the downhill side.
I'm on the bottom side, yeah, underneath.
Your house is undergoing some renovations.
It is, yes.
We saw out on site. There's a drainage easement, I believe, through the rear of your property.
There is. There's a pipe.
Which is in favour of the immediately adjoining property, but
yes.
Not both properties.
No. It was only put in for the benefit of the retaining wall in its right. current form.
Okay.
And I was told by an engineer who was arranged to come and speak to me about that particular easement that it would be beneficial for our land because it would help to stop the constant flow of water through our property and that it would be sufficient for the land as it stands now.
So the easement is just a recipe.
The easement, yes. It, yep. There's a box, a collection box, yep. And it just pipes straight into Kelly's Creek.
Yeah, and it's an easement legally created on your title.
Yes, it is.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, Bernard.
The retaining wall was constructed after a DA was provided for it?
Yes, it was.
And the fact that it appears that there's a sewer main in the back of the property adjoining yours.
Yes, there is.
We didn't have any sewer diagram to access, and we were assuming that it runs down through the back of your property.
Yes, it does.
So the retaining wall is bridging.
Yes, the sewer main. It's actually bridging the sewer main.
And so was it designed? Was the retaining wall designed to build over the sewer?
It was. I watched the builders when they were building, and they actually stated that they had to put their piers a certain distance apart so that it actually allowed for the sewer main.
And the depth.
And the depth.
Okay. Thanks.
All right. Thank you very much. The applicant might want to take note of those questions too because the applicant's here, are they? Yeah, you can expect some of those questions coming your way as well. Erin Bunting is the next speaker. There's two seats down here for you. Who have we got? Erin and
Tate.
Tate. Sorry, I beg your pardon. Erin and Tate.
Okay. Good evening. My name is Erin, and I'm 14 years old, and I too live at 182 Lawrence Hargrave Drive, Thrule. I'm also speaking on behalf of my brother Tate, who is 12 years old. We have a few concerns we would like to address. We feel these issues would affect us if the development was to take place. Firstly, I would like to address the issue of overshadowing and how it will affect me. Due to the enormous size of the building, my bedroom will have next to no natural lighting. All my indoor plants would suffer, and I would need to have my light on more often. In fact, the whole backyard would be mostly in shadow in winter, affecting our animals and plants. This is an issue we are both concerned with. The next issue is privacy, or lack of. There would be three units facing directly at our house, my bedroom window, our bathroom window, our deck, and our entire backyard. I would feel very uncomfortable in my room with such a large number of people possibly looking down at me. I spend a lot of time in my room as I have a lot of surgery, and I've always considered my room at my comfortable place. If this development happens, I feel that this would change. With there being 15 bedrooms in the plans, there are a lot of people looking into our yard, looking at our washing on the line, looking into our windows and watching us in our backyard. Tate often plays in our backyard with his friends and with the neighbour's children. He said he would feel awkward being watched. Mum showed me the plans of the flexi brick privacy screening. I'm sure people can still see through the gaps, only we wouldn't see them looking at us. The last concern is noise. The driveway runs along our side. All of the bedrooms are on the same side. The cars coming in and out and car doors opening and closing is potentially going to affect our sleeping. Three of the balconies look straight at us too. So every time people are on the balconies talking, listening to music and or entertaining, the noise will travel straight to our bedrooms. This potential development has caused our family a lot of stress, with our mum and dad having to spend a lot of time reading lots of information and writing submissions. Our mum has been in and out of hospital during this time, and it upsets both of us that she is under all this extra stress. We think that a new building would be great next door, but we had to stick to the rules for our extension, and other people should have to stick to the rules too. Thank you for this opportunity to speak this evening.
Thank you very much. Well done. I'm sure Mum is very proud. Okay, next speaker is Matt Bunting.
Good evening, panel. Thanks for the opportunity to speak and make a bit of a presentation to you today. Bear with me, a little bit nervous. But, firstly, I'd just like to thank you for your opportunity to speak. My full official name, William Matthew Bunting. I reside at 182 Lawrence Hargrave Drive, Thrule. I would also like to state very clearly that I'm not at all opposed to a site being developed and would welcome any appropriate structure that complies and fits with the visual amenity that is Thrule Village. This evening I'm going to address the car parking and traffic issues. I've read the report presented by Council for this evening's meeting and note that the RMS had no issues with extra traffic. Looking at this issue from a resident's perspective, there are huge issues. Current DA proposes that the driveway is situated on the southern side of the block along our property boundary. I do not object to this positioning, but to the amount of traffic that will be utilising it. According to the Australian Bureau of Statistics, there are more registered cars than people. Statistically, there are 19.2 million registered cars, that's excluding unregistered vehicles, and 19.1 million people in Australia. With a building of 15 bedrooms, I doubt very much there would only be 10 cars and one visitor at a time, as allocated in the DA. This would lead to cars being parked along the boundary line and on the road, with many more residents choosing to use their garage for storage purposes and not to park their cars in. As the current plans show, no storage areas for belongings such as bikes, surfboards, camping gear, or any other items the family may have. I'm also unsure as to where the bins would be stored, as the plan shows them in the garage. Lawrence Hargrave Drive is a very busy road, being the only road in and out of Thrule and much of the northern suburbs of Illawarra. On weekends, as we rarely drive anywhere due to the large amount of traffic that is quite often bumper to bumper at stages. This is only exacerbated when Bulleye Pass is closed or there's a major incident on the M1. There's no stopping area just up the hill, which extends approximately 250 metres from the Thrule into the Ostermere Township boundary, and also down the road, approximately 80 metres of no stopping area for the bus zones. Imagine the effects of what another 10 to 15, maybe more cars parked on the road would do. There would be more cars attempting to exit and enter from the heavy traffic flow, and parked cars would be blocking the visual field of residents attempting to do the same. The amount of extra cars parked could potentially block driveways, as seen around many other multi-dwelling areas, and as reported by local residents in the immediate area. Thrule and Ostermere have many pedestrians, enough to justify council to install another footpath on the western side of Lawrence Hargrave Drive. These pedestrians would be difficult to see around a large number of parked cars for people turning in and out of their driveways. The closest designated crossings are at the Ostermere Shops opposite Ostermere Public School and at the Thrule Shops opposite IGA. Many people use crossings across Kennedy's Hill predominantly going to and from the beach areas and to get home from the beach, obviously. Pedestrians would have to stand on the roadside to enable them to see oncoming traffic, putting themselves at risk. These pedestrians are children going to and from school, elderly people walking their dogs, and any number in between. As Lawrence Hargrave Drive is a scenic drive, there are vast numbers of cyclists using this stretch of roadway. The cycle is advertised on Council's website. Kennedy's Hill has unfortunately been the scene of many car bicycle accidents, with one many years ago resulting in the death of a cyclist from a resident attempting to exit his driveway. As vision would be obscured from the extra parked cars, this could indeed happen again. It is not uncommon to hear sirens of emergency vehicles racing past our home. As I stated earlier, Lawrence Hargrave Drive is the only road to much of the northern suburbs. And with extra street parking would undoubtedly pose a problem to the emergency services. It would be hard enough to race to an emergency without the added burden of vehicles being unable to pull over due to unnecessary parked cars. The extra noise from these extra cars would inevitably cause upset to local residents. Yes, Lawrence Hargrave Drive is constantly busy, but not with car doors opening and closing, car engines starting, and people chatting and getting out of their cars. Sorry, 2 moments. Okay. Sorry, it won't be too much longer. All these cars would obviously need to be washed, which would be on a cement driveway. There's no grassed areas for this. This would mean all car washing chemicals and residues would potentially enter into Kelly's Creek via the drainage pipe without any filtration that would normally occur when washing on the grass. To say this runoff would flow directly into the containment pit and possibly overflow onto our property also, as would happen in flash flooding incident. Another issue I'd like to brush on is landscaping. On the current DA, there appears to be vegetation planted along the southern side of the block, along the edge of the retaining wall. I'm unsure how this would work, given the entire length consists of gravel, ag pipe and pit. Any vegetation planted on the wall would have the potential to damage the wall by extra pressure, especially from the root system. Any vegetation planted along the southern aspect would also not address any privacy issues. It would only add to debris on the on our property by way of leaf litter. I've read attachment 6, view sharing, on page 15 of Council's report and fully agree with this that this development would have a severe impact upon us on 182 Lawrence Hargrave Drive.
Can you sum up in 30 seconds, please?
Can I finish? I've only got a little bit to go. So, basically, well, in total, I agree with Council's position to reject this application in its current form and would urge the developers to consider something a little bit more practical and within the guidelines of council and coastal plans.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, guys, for your time. And I'll just begin.
Thank you. The next speaker is Lisa Crawford.
Lisa Crawford, 176 Lawrence Hargrave Drive, Thirroul. I'm here to represent the Crawford family, but more broadly, our iconic Thirroul village. Before I start, I'd like to concur with the previous speakers and state that we not only share their concerns, but that they have formed a significant part of our previous 3 detailed written objections. However, in the interests of efficiency and to avoid repetition, tonight I'll only be speaking on the issues of privacy, security and lifestyle. With the development of 5 connected dwellings, potentially housing 25 people on approximately 1,300 square metres, just over a quarter of an acre block, we believe that our privacy and in turn our lifestyle will be compromised severely. The proposed development has 4 backyards facing our living areas. Without any provision for deep soil planting of tall trees in each of these backyards, and without any break in the construction of the townhouses, we will be faced with 20 neighbours and their guests having an unobscured view into our private lives. This is a radical shift from the current fibro dwelling next door, which provides privacy and a peaceful green western aspect. We will be confronted with residents and their guests looking into areas we currently regard as sanctuaries, where we move freely in our dining room, sunroom and lounge room, where we socialise and carry out our home office duties without our privacy being invaded. Instead, we will be in the view of any resident of the new development who wishes to watch us. And there will be no way of screening out this problem. It won't be a matter of closing blinds in the evening. This is a fair expectation. Rather, we will be compelled to close blinds every hour of the day we are at home. The driveway of 176A Lawrence Hargrave Drive is built along the boundary, so it is impossible to make provisions for tree planting on our side of the fence. Now, at the moment, we overlook the small one-storey fibro dwelling and green backyard of 178 Lawrence Hargrave Drive. The side yard of this property is so narrow that an individual cannot utilise it for any recreational purpose. As a result, this southwestern outlook guarantees peace and quiet and provides respite from the busy traffic southeast on Lawrence Hargrave Drive. This southeastern perspective overlooking Lawrence Hargrave Drive understandably does not afford any privacy. Our eastern, or more accurately, northeastern perspective is viewed from bedrooms that are only a metre or so from the boundary and 2 metres from the neighbouring house on 174 Lawrence Hargrave Drive, which means that curtains must already be drawn for privacy purposes. Our rumpus room at the back of the house is only a metre from the boundary and 2 metres from the northwestern dwelling of 176A Lawrence Hargrave Drive. Essentially, from every direction, we are hemmed in by buildings that prevent privacy. So we consider the one remaining western perspective, access from our dining room, lounge room and sunroom, to be vital for our privacy needs. To summarise, in addition to the concerns raised by other speakers tonight, we think that 3 major issues warrant the refusal of this DA. Firstly, on the issue of safety. We will be in the view of residents in the new development and will not feel safe enough to walk around our own home. Secondly, on the issue of health, we will be forced to close our blinds for the entire day, and on top of the overshadowing problems to be discussed, we will be deprived of any direct sunlight as a consequence of having the blinds closed 24/7. And thirdly, on the issue of lifestyle, we will lose our escarpment view and any incentive to spend time in living areas for which we have paid dearly. The unbroken line of dwellings means there can be no escarpment glimpses or even dedicated tree space between the townhouses to compensate for these lost views. The developer has not taken into account the trauma caused by such a massive lifestyle change. Having given this DA sympathetic consideration, we currently support the development of 3 separate villas, incorporating lush garden areas and designed with the aesthetic features, environmental safeguards and lifestyle qualities that have come to be associated with iconic villages like Thirroul in the 21st century. We think that this is a powerful moment in our history, a history that has regrettably already recorded innumerable development disasters throughout New South Wales, but particularly in the Illawarra and regional areas of Sydney. We passionately support the Illawarra as the vanguard of progress, but progress that is environmentally and socially responsible. We want the Illawarra to stand proud as a 21st century model for communities around Australia. Please help save Thirroul by refusing this development application.
Thank you for that. The next speaker is Amanda Coombs.
I currently reside to the south of 178 and 180 Lawrence Hargrave Drive. Thorall. My property backs onto and is side-facing of Kelly's Creek. We are concerned and will address the issue of increased discharge of stormwater runoff through to the downstream properties. Council states that it must clearly demonstrate that the post-development flow rates and flow concentration from the development site are not greater than the pre-development condition. The developers have failed to show that their proposal will not result in a significant impact to the local environment. Due to the slope of the property at issue, the proposed drainage will flow via the back of the property rather than towards the street. The footprint of the proposed development includes not only the area occupied by the townhouses, but also a driveway that spans the majority of the side of the property. As we understand it, the proposed deep soil area is not actually soil, but rather rubble, builder's waste and asbestos, which was evident at recent excavations of the property. This will greatly increase stormwater runoff in times of high rain into the downhill creek. This creek runs downstream over adjacent properties which are at high risk of flash flooding. Without the additional predicted impact of the proposed development, flash flooding has occurred two times in the past 2 years and has affected properties 182, 184 and 186 Lawrence Hardgrove Drive and 11 Henley Road, Thorall. We are greatly concerned that the proposed development will put our properties at an increased risk of additional and more frequent flash flooding. We have requested that the council require the developer to submit a stormwater flooding report showing no increased flow from rainwater runoff instead of accepting the adjacent and simplistic drainage drawings that have been previously submitted. Community members are not persuaded that a proper engineering study of such environmental impacts has occurred. We understand that the additional runoff from the development will only add to the existing flooding issues in the area, as the upstream catchment for the design of the subject development has been underestimated. If this development is accepted in its current form, it will adversely affect our property and current lifestyle. We want to ensure that there is no detrimental erosion from the property or an increase in stormwater runoff velocity, and does not, through materials utilised, degrade the environmental quality of stormwater that does flow downstream, both of which will affect the local environment. On a more personal level, this development has caused significant stress due to the developer resubmitting the same proposal without taking into consideration the community's concern of view impact, privacy, and the issue of exceeding the floor space ratio. As Council states in their assessment report, it is not considered that the proposed development has been designed appropriately and has the potential to result in significant adverse impacts on the amenity of the surrounding area. The developer's failure to properly consider the impacts of this property in the first place and continued failure to reconsider its plans or propose alternatives to lessen impacts when challenged by the community is notable. We strongly recommend that this DA be determined by way of refusal for these reasons. Thank you.
Thank you for that. The next speaker is Bryce Smith. Thank you. Just for the record, Mr. Smith is not going to speak because he feels that the areas have been covered by other speakers. Thank you. Murray Jones.
Thank you for this opportunity to address this meeting. I'm a concerned resident of Thorall. I wish to state my support for the council staff's assessment of the DA as revealed last Wednesday. I think all residents depend on council's planning staff to ensure the correct application of local environment plans and development control plans as legislated. They underpin the natural amenity that our community enjoys. I'll try to avoid repeating council staff's analysis and just concentrate on delivering an additional point of view on the exemptions to the three-storey limit, the minimal impact of shading on neighbours, exemptions to the floor space ratio limit, and exemptions to the deep soil planting requirements. This area has a limit of two storeys. According to the Wollongong Development Control Plan, the second objective of this limit is to minimise the potential impact of overshadowing and overlooking on adjacent dwellings and open space areas. Now, it can be observed that the slope of the land effectively places the ground level of this development at least one storey above the neighbours. Thus, the potential impact of this building is amplified from three storeys to be more like a four-storey building. Thus, how is it possible for this building to minimise the potential impacts of overshadowing and overlooking if it is allowed to have the effect of a four-storey building? Given the downhill slope of the site, cannot it be argued that this development will have the physical impact of a four-storey building on the three closest neighbouring properties on the downhill side, and is thus arguably one of the worst sites in Thirroul for exemption to the number of storeys and shading minimisation? The applicant seeks an extra 30.5 square metres of floor space across the overall development above what he is allowed. This is equivalent to three extra bedrooms. I believe the Council's response to this covers in detail the reasons why this should not be approved. The applicant seeks to reduce the area of the block that is set aside for deep soil planting. Now, this area is specified in the development control plan as a minimal figure proportional to the overall size of the block. Now, given that this is a sloping block with clear evidence of the ground sliding downhill over time and with questionable quality fill, the chances of successful planting and growing of trees that would be capable of holding the ground together is significantly reduced. Therefore, is the use of a minimal figure for the deep soil planting zone suitable? Should the area set aside for deep soil planting at this specific site be along the northern boundary for the sake of land stability and also privacy? So I'd just like to conclude with, given the steep slope and the history of instability of this land, given the significant impact of shading on its neighbours, given the need for deep soil planting to help stabilise the land, I believe the planned building is simply too big for the site. Could I suggest that this panel reject the claims for variation and ask the applicant to stick to the rules under the guidance of Wollongong City Council, with the addition of at least a deep soil zone along the north side boundary, a reduction in the number of the bedrooms, and extra parking facilities. Thank you for this opportunity to speak.
Thank you for that. The next speaker is Bernadette Felton.
Hello, Mr. Chair, panel, everybody. I'm exhausted just from hearing that. I really just wanted to say that I live at 7 Hillcrest Road, Austinmere, so I'm not a neighbour to this property. So I really wasn't going to sort of come. But then I spoke to some other people that live in Austinmere, and we just really feel, from the, I obviously you can only take my word on that, so but I'm here because I believe that I need to support the people that live in there, in that area. I don't believe, from what I read, and you would have read all the submissions, that I couldn't justify why the height was being exceeded. That's obviously your job. I couldn't understand why they said it didn't look like it would be three stories. I couldn't read that. I'm no expert. So it just raised some red flags to me about, and also I didn't feel that it really, to quote the lovely lady over there, I didn't feel it was the vibe of our area. So it's a little bit too harsh. I love some other suggestions that you made about, you know, breaking it up and some trees in between. I think, yeah, definitely, it's got to be done, and I support it happening, and, you know, more power to you, make money and whoever you are there, but good luck. But I just would like to see some sort of balance, and that's really it.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
The next speaker is Martin Gorick. Martin here? Can't make it? Okay. Jamie Quinn.
Thank you, members of the panel, for the opportunity to speak. My name is Jamie Quinn, and I'm the owner of 4 of 17 Mountain Road, Austenmere. The southern side of my property directly backs onto the proposed development site at 178 Lawrence Hargrave Drive, Thirroul. I've read through the plans and application details that were made available on the council website. My concerns are in relation to the general size and building height of the proposed townhouses in the development. Further to this, I'm concerned with the windows associated with the townhouses being developed. The window attached to the southern side of my property has a pleasant outlook of houses with ocean views. I am concerned that my view will be completely obstructed, which will essentially be replaced with the views of walls, which can make myself and my family feel enclosed, overshadowed and congested. I feel that my privacy could also be impeded, as there will be windows from the townhouses that would look directly into my house. The particular window that I am referencing can be seen from my kitchen, lounge and dining room areas. It is a major window within my property. I also have a courtyard with a clothesline attached to the southern end of my property. The development of the townhouses will affect the sunlight to the courtyard and may also affect the sunlight into my property through the window that I've previously mentioned. There is a large number of units on the western side of my property, and I feel that additional multi-level townhouses being developed behind me would change the outlook of the property and make the general feel of the property to be more enclosed and congested. I agree with some of the points that have been raised by previous speakers, and I also agree with the council's proposal to reject the application. Thank you.
Can I just ask, just to clarify, you're at 17, is it?
Yes, 17. Number 4 of 17.
And that's at the back of the property,
yep.
Obviously.
It's that's correct.
Unit?
Yes, yep. Townhouse.
A townhouse, right. Okay. Okay, thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you. That completes the list of registered speakers who are here as submitters. Is there anybody who wishes to speak as a submitter who didn't register? No? Well, I have Steve Hughes, the applicant, here, and I notice that his architect, Mr. Gizzy, is with him. As I mentioned to the other applicants and other speakers, you have 5 minutes, but the panel would certainly expect that you respond to some of the concerns raised. Thank you.
Okay, thank you for this opportunity. I'd just like to talk in some broad terms about the project in terms of what it's a response to, which is that it's addressing a pent-up demand in the northern suburbs, particularly in Thirroul, for people to downsize. They're looking for high-quality, low-maintenance homes, particularly retirees. And as a result, we've come up with this concept, which includes lifts as a direct response to that. There's been discussion around the fact that we're seeking a variation regarding the third level for the parking, which affects effectively half of the building. There are some key benefits to this. In particular, the setbacks that are afforded as a result of a smaller footprint for the size of the development means that we have setbacks of 5.8 on one side and up to 12.6 metres on the other. This is, the 12.6 metres obviously is significantly in excess of what the DCP requires. There are also benefits in terms of the setback compared to complying development requirements, or indeed just a standard typical independent dwelling, which would have setbacks of 900 millimetres, and we've provided a drawing that demonstrates the kind of difference in the impact in that regard. The proposal complies with height. FSR, there were some additional drawings were submitted last week to account for the 0.02 discrepancy that was identified by council, and we understand that that now complies, which leaves the key issue of bulk and scale. the scheme takes advantage of a sloping block, and as a result, we have subterranean parking. To all intents and purposes, the development presents to the street as a two-story dwelling. The southwestern aspect is three-story in some regards. However, it does step back up the hill, which does compound the impact of that. But that's mitigated by planting along the boundary and also with planters along the first level. The bulk and scale is consistent with the area, and using council's words, the area is characterised by a mixture of development. The three-storey component is consistent with a number of other dwellings within the area. Indeed, within 160, 170 metres of the dwelling, there are some 20 other structures with three-storey components and with some with similar or even larger bulk and scale. I might hand over to Rob to address some of the more detailed issues.
Good evening. Good evening. Thank you very much for the opportunity to talk. I just want to recap on Steve's comment. There were amended drawings submitted to council in relation to FSR, and the FSR was complying, and we've now further made it to comply. So I hope the panel's got those drawings or had a look at those drawings.
Just in relation to that, the panel's aware that there's been some amended drawings submitted, but they're certainly not with our package of information. I mean, they were submitted pretty late in the day, and they after the agendas were compiled, as I understand it.
No, so that's correct. Yep.
And I understand that the council staff haven't had a chance to assess those plans either.
Right. Okay. It's my understanding. Sorry, my understanding that they were going to be distributed, but if it hasn't happened, it hasn't happened. I just want to talk about character, and I'd like to recap on the issue that the areas, there is a lot of free, you know, three-storey developments, a lot of multi-unit developments. The area has got a lot of modern type of architecture as far as the architectural intent. There's buildings with different type of materials, different types of cladding. So we tried to be respectful as far as providing a modern response. The use of, you know, cladding, brickwork, a lot of timber elements, screening elements is very important to our proposal, as well as on some of the balconies as extremely large planters which provide assist with the overlooking issues that have been raised by the submitters today. As far as living areas are concerned, two of the living areas on the front dwellings face the street. The three units to the rear have living areas which is generally on ground because they're on the northern side of the building. There are small courtyards on the south side, but they're not the primary open space, and those courtyards are more relief spaces, and they're not big enough to house more than two or three people. They're quite small, intimate spaces. They have deep planters, so in accordance with our sections that we provided, there's no opportunity to look down on those from those living spaces through, as well as on the bedrooms which face to the south side. There's five bedrooms which face south. The windows to the stair lobbies are actually opaque glass, so when you're walking down the stairs, you do not have a view out. The windows are clear, high level. The three bedrooms which face south are actually at sills of 1,300 above finished floor level. There are only three main bedrooms, and the units to the units to the front, the three bedrooms to the front, have screening on the upper level. So, and all the screen and louvers are directed towards the street. In regards to the deep soil, council has considered the deep soil and landscaping to be satisfactory. And as far as overshadowing impacts, page 22 of council's report says that the shadowings they're incorrect. We've actually done half an hour shadowing intervals, and the shadowing impacts do comply on private open space and living areas to adjacent properties, and we're happy to, you know, expand on those if required. So I disagree with council's comments in relation to the overshadowing because they do comply. The coastal environment, the report, you know, is this building acceptable? Is it fair? And the report, as far as it does not have an impact on the scenic values of the area, in it, generally speaking. The building is designed to step with the topography, which is quite evident when you look at the streetscape provided. It actually sits lower than the adjacent building on the northern side. As far as a tapering streetscape, it actually fits quite comfortably with the buildings either side. As far as the three-storey component is concerned, the main issues with that is that the three-storey component does not create any overshadowing issues, does not create loss of privacy due to the uses behind uses in that area, as well as the screening measures. And I would like to just cap on the objector's comments, if that's okay. The first speaker, Mrs. Button, discussed issues of the retaining wall. You know, the retaining wall actually is structurally compliant. We're more than happy for the application to have a dilapidation report, have that report further expanded on, and if there are any geotechnical conditions or issues relation to was mentioned about asbestos, I think that that's certainly happy to take that remediation or analysis further if required. Aaron and Tate Bunting, overshadowing, I just want to recap that the proposal does comply for requirements of overshadowing, does comply for requirements of privacy. There is screening, there is definite large balconies. The primary living spaces are on ground level, which are actually lower than the court, lower than the natural ground on the northern side, and the balconies have great depth, so it's impossible to stand on the balcony on the south side to look directly out. Mr. Matt Butting's comment about visual amenity, I feel like I've dealt with that issue. Where we provided screening on the upper levels, we provided opaque glazing to mitigate any overlooking issues. The plans now have a dedicated bin storage area. We comply with the bin storage area to the frontage of the street, which is more than 50%. And there are also the parking does comply with the parking requirements. And we have been contacted by the RMS, and they are happy with the proposal. We have got contact from the RMS. Miss Lisa Crawford, the driveways have got a landscape strip. The density does comply, the FSR does comply, and there is, once again, any possible opportunity to provide screening, outlook and orientation of spaces, we've certainly taken that on board. As far as Ms. Amanda Coombs, the discharge of water, we have engaged Opta Engineering to look at the opportunity for water. We feel we comply with that policy, but further again, we're happy to take any extra additional work as far as if there's any clarification required, and if there is potential flood report required to further understand that those impacts. Mr. Jones, as far as the three-storey height limit, the building complies with the overall 9-metre height. The sections where it doesn't comply are only in bedroom spaces. These bedroom spaces are low use, they have high-level windows, and they're screened. And I just want to recap that the floor space does comply, as well as the any geotechnical report that is required. We can certainly accommodate that, which will be required as part of our further structural work. And I'd probably just like to comment on that the private open spaces to the proposal, they are actually at a lower level than the adjacent northern properties. So I think that the issue of people looking into those spaces are mitigated due to the fact that the northern front dwelling adjacent has a driveway, and there is quite a reasonably blank wall to the rear dwelling at the rear on the northern side. So once again, I would like the panel to consider the application before us and consider the reasons why we're here, and also consider that is this development reasonable or not, and we consider it to be reasonable, and we'd respectfully request the panel to provide to support to overturn council's decision and provide opportunity to have a positive determination on the application. Thank you.
Thank you for that. Are there any questions from the panel? I'm sure there are. Microphone, please, Bernard.
Look, I'm not familiar with the flex brick thing. Is it... It's not completely opaque, is it?
No, the flexibrick is it's a stainless steel mesh, there's brick tiles which are solid, and then there's other brick tiles which are open. So it provides a dappled effect. It provides opportunity for light to come in, provides opportunity to view out, but it does restrict people to be standing in a large opening looking out. So it does.
No, but I mean, it affords people to be able to look out, but 100%. We need not that. So necessarily the same visual aspects, not in reverse. People can't see in.
If you can see through a 150mm by 230mm opening from a distance, you've got better eyesight than I've got. But it aids the opportunity for people to provide a screen, and it's off the window space as well.
I think you'd feel you wouldn't be sure if someone was looking at you through one of these panels, but they could well be.
Well, that can be on it.
Yeah.
May well be on that
window. But, I mean, if they're looking at you through a window, you can see them looking at you through a window.
But the reason for the flexibility is that when you're there, when you're inside or outside, you actually get an opportunity to actually look through and you've got sort of breaking glimpses. So
I can see the advantage for the people having them.
Yeah. It's also a privacy measure from outside as well.
Other questions? No? Well, I've got a few, so it's probably up to me. You mentioned you'd do further analysis on remediation if required. What analysis have you done to date on potential contamination?
We've undertaken a geotechnical assessment, but in terms of specific contamination, we haven't done any work to date, apart from when the construction of the retaining wall took place. Fragments of asbestos were found and they were dealt with in the appropriate manner.
So it's more likely than not that there is some contamination.
It's possible, yeah. Yeah.
I don't think it's unreasonable that the applicant, if the DA were to approve, to have that condition, or depending on the phase of remediation work, if required.
Well, you probably need to understand that under State Environmental Planning Policy 55, consent authority needs to be satisfied that there's either no contamination or that there is some contamination and it can be remediated. We don't have any information before us in relation to that. So that's certainly a difficulty. And I mentioned that to the first applicant tonight as well.
Sure. I mean, we can easily address that for you if that's a requirement.
Retaining wall, you mentioned that it's structurally sound, but I noticed that there's no occupation certificate.
Yeah, that's an oversight. All the documentation was provided to the certifier. They never issued the occupation certificate, and it was an administration issue in terms of not chasing it up from them. But everything's in place, and it has been issued. It just needs to be provided to council.
Just on the retaining wall, was that constructed with the forethought that this development was going to take place, or it was just done as a standalone development?
Well, the sites were acquired for development purposes, so yes.
Okay.
I just want to note that how this development is constructed, there's many ways of constructing this development, so it's unlikely that the development will be bearing on that retaining wall.
There's got to be peering beyond the zone of influence.
So that peering should be independent, if I wasn't involved. Be independent of that retaining wall and have that retaining wall as an isolated structure.
Yeah. I just noted today, we didn't view the retaining wall from the adjoining property, but just looking along the line, there is a deviation in alignment of the retaining wall, not to a great degree at this moment, but given, as people said, it's only 12 months old or less than 12 months old, it's a concern that it's moving so quickly.
Yeah, so the highest grade timber was used for that, and I mean some movement always going to take place as it cures. So the structural engineer considers it to be within the realm of variation.
As it stands at the moment, it appears okay. I mean, as we didn't inspect it from below, but we just inspected from there. There is some deviation in line. I'm not saying it might have been built like that, but
yeah. So that boundary does change direction at one point. I'm not sure if that was the point at which you're looking.
We weren't specifically behind that.
I noticed that there's a sewer main running across the rear of the property in the deep soil zone. How deep is it?
It's about 2.5 metres.
And what's the zone of influence that you have to avoid?
In terms of, we've submitted documentation from Sydney Water that I can't remember off the top of my head what it is, but the documentation suggests that by relocating the palms that are on site within that zone, we can achieve a deep soil zone that's effective. But you can plant relatively close with a palm because of the root zone.
Well, the purpose of a deep soil zone is to establish plants and trees that require deep soil because of their root.
Yep.
Their root habits. So planting palms in a deep soil zone, you don't need a deep soil zone for palms. So I'm just wondering, how do you plant deep soil type trees in a deep soil zone with a sewer main that's only 2.4 metres underground?
Okay, well, there's a, I guess there's a couple of issues there. The first is reusing the palms, which are native and appropriate. It's sustainable in terms of taking those palms and relocating them, so there is a benefit to doing that.
Is there an arborist report on the palms?
Yes, there is, yeah. Secondly, at the northern end, the deep soil zone's over 9 metres wide, which provides adequate space to plant deep soil, to plant trees with a deeper soil, root zone rather, a deeper root. There are a number of existing trees that are retained as well.
So really what you're saying is that the deep soil zone shown on the plans is not in effect all deep soil zone.
Well, no, it
is. You can't plant deep soil plants in certain areas.
Well, you can, but... Well,
you've just said that you can't. That's why you're putting palms there.
No, the palms...
Sorry, I misheard you.
Yeah, no, the palms are being relocated because they're already on site. So it's common sense to relocate those.
And they don't have a big root system?
No, they don't.
Right, okay.
So there are advantages to that, but there can be a mix of native trees and palms that's totally appropriate to that space.
I noticed that also that there's a drainage easement on the property below your land, and one of your two properties benefits from that drainage easement, not both of them. How are you proposing to overcome that? How are you going to drain the upper property?
Well, they would both drain into that because they, at the moment, they all drain down that hill. It would take advantage of that easement. I'd have to take some legal advice in terms of answering your question in that regard.
Okay. All right. Thank you for that. Any other questions? No. Okay. Well, thank you. There's some... Yeah, sit down, please, gentlemen. Sorry? Oh, no, sorry. It's just that there's some hands up in the audience. I'm happy to answer a couple of quick questions, but there's everyone who has their hands up has already had an opportunity to speak, so I don't want to hear any more comment. If you have a question of me, I'm happy to answer it if I can. So, you first. So they weren't talking about your house?
They were, but I think they've got their...
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, well, as I said, you've asked the question, it's been answered. So the next is more people behind you with their hands up. So quickly...
My name's Ross Dearden. I was just wanting to explore the comment about...
And sorry, where do you live?
I live in Hawaii.
Right. The proposal complies with the building height limitation in the LEP. It doesn't comply with the three-storey limitation in the DCP, and what I understood the architect to be saying is that the only parts of the building which are three-storey are where there are bedrooms and they have highlight windows. Next question. It's probably something that you can take up with the applicant because I understand your concern there. The retaining wall's right on your boundary and you're below it. So you really need to, regardless of the outcome of tonight, you really need to be talking to the owner. Okay, thank you very much for your attendance. As I said earlier, our decision will be placed on council's website within 3 working days Again, thank you for your attention. I'll formally close the meeting at 7:34.